even Pan American, it's customary, would not permit what they consider to be unwarranted errors in the contract performance.
I see. That didn't hold up.
Not very long, because he said, you know, no matter what Pan American bought, that's not where I'm going. I am going to investigate, go in and check out these plants. I want to be familiar with them. And this was an outfit that made was heavy into the air conditioning business, but they also made jet engines. Well, they had a contract to build the air conditioning system for the capsule.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think about that. That capsule was, you've seen it, I'm sure, over at the spaceport.
Oh, yes.
Had an air conditioning system would range from let's see, what, 1700 below zero Fahrenheit, that is to say, and the heat factor.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Was great.
Right.
Had to go up, control it, keep it within a few degrees through that temperature range.
Mm.
That would, and of course the temperature range was involved the
well, with that re-entry, the atmospheric re-entry, of course, everything, the heat would really go up, right?
Yeah. So it was quite a complex operation, and involved in that was they were having a problem with the radiator, which was associated with this project, which had a number of blind soldering points.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting one good one out of 11. And Reese thought this was unheard of.
Hmm.
That's why he wanted to go. Well, the upshot of it was that he insisted that they go. He was going to report this matter to the administrator, as he was entitled to do. And they finally got this contractor to set up a briefing. And it was a typical standard program, you know, arrive at this, pick one of them, arrive there. Have a greeting by the president, have a briefing by some of their engineers, donuts and coffee and that kind of thing. And then they would be furnished transportation back to the where we were located, this town, Downey.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Reese looked at that and paid no attention to it whatsoever. He got there early, and he went through it, and he said, oh, now we will visit the plant. This was, oh, just not done. But we went through the plant in great detail. And during the briefing, Reese would break in with questions about what was being done. And one specific question was of a nature that required the head of that particular activity to be on the spot to reveal it. Like, for example, well, that's Charlie so-and-so's job, and he said, where is this Charlie?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, he's not here, he's home. We must speak to him. You call him up and tell him we will see him in 15, 20 minutes. If that's the degree, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
The guy arrived at the shelf. And, but we went through through the plant, and in great detail that he had questions. We got home, instead of being home by noon, we didn't get home till 11 o'clock that night.
Mm-hmm.
He had these guys, he had guys called in to describe what was going on, and this. And then he said, in the end, we will send, I will send you a man skilled in this type of performance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't think it'd be necessary. I think it's necessary.
Right.
Well, the upshot of all that was, instead of 1 out of 11, they got something like 9 out of 11.
Is that right?
They had, what was his name?
Huh.
He had a notoriously poor personality. He had an angry personality, but out he went.
So, and this was with Pan American, did you say?
No, with, I can't remember the name of it. I don't think it was Carrier.
Huh.
But it was a responsible outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the word gets around, you know, real quick, and we never had any problems thereafter going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given a certain number of subcontractors, subcontract to visit, to look around the plant, see if something was going on, and to address the foreman of the various operations. And that was onerous for us, was a very worthwhile undertaking, because these guys had no idea on earth that they were that closely tied to the space program.
Mm-hmm.
Little things, you know.
And yet, right, the smallest of contractors' item that they were making could be of critical importance to the whole success.
Right. And they were very, very, very well received.
Mm-hmm.
We spent several hours talking to these foremen.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very worthwhile. And I think it was an extremely helpful program that was instituted by Dr. Reed.
Right.
And then we found out, too, that we found out when we went into the capsule that was off limits to everybody but the workers and Reese.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese went down, and they had very stringent regulations concerning the carrying in that area of loose items. You're supposed to wear a suit with no pockets in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first one he went into, this was at 2 o'clock in the morning after we got there. He called me up and said, well, we go to see the manufacturing area in North America. And that shocked him, because no one had ever done that before.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into the capsule under manufacture, and he found things in there like pens.
Little wrenches and whatever.
All kinds of trash, and these guys not have being supervised, you know, engineers.
Uh-huh.
It was a serious situation, and there's this that resulted in report which was called the Phillips Report. I don't know whether you ever heard of that or not.
Tillits?
Phillips.
Oh, Phillips. Phillips. I certainly did. Scathing report.
Very.
Yes.
And it was pulled.
Mm-hmm.
And numbered copies and all that, but our copy was pulled.
Mm-hmm.
because they were going to have the Thompson, Mr. Thompson report, which was Thompson was a high-ranking engineer and had lots of familiarity with the space program. He was the one who headed the committee that investigated that accident. They had their things like different gauges of wire spliced, and it was strictly forbidden that there be any splicing whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Reese found out that on his own. And he also found out that there were really no specifications as such for varying kinds of wire. He even went to the point of going up to a wire drawing plant in Vermont so he could be more familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the degree to which we went. And I was charged with reviewing their drawing room practice, in which once a drawing is approved, signed off on by the engineer responsible, it went into the library and was there closely controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And you were supposed to have a very close justification for using it. And we found cases where erasers, pencil entries, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And altogether, this was not a very
Of course, if this hadn't been straightened out, there's very good reason to believe we never would have achieved that Apollo goal.
I'm convinced of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this one too. The third stage was the stage Boeing was building that stage, but the S2 stage is the one I was familiar with,
mm-hmm.
the first one, then following it with the capsule.
Right.
And it was really, this was Johnson's responsibility to look into all these things. They didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have done it.
They just didn't have that arsenal-based, I mean, the arsenal methodology and prototype manuscript and hands-on manufacturing in your own shop so you can better monitor what your private contractors are doing.
Right. And these things were all straightened out. And of course, thereafter, while there was no single failure in the Saturn program.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the astronauts all knew about this too. They were
sure they appreciated it.
The degree of interest which recent assistants were describing what they were doing.
Speaking of which, do you recall any specifics about any of the relationships that Dr. von Braun had with the astronauts?
Well, he knew all of them, and he made a point of meeting all of them.
Mm-hmm.
He always stressed the fact to his workers, you are dealing with human lives. I know von Braun spoke perfect English.
Mm-hmm.
There was no accent.
Mm-hmm.
Reese was a little different.
Right.
His expression used to amuse the hell out of me.
Huh.
I heard this. Now, I didn't have witnessed this, but von Braun was also a little bit on the eccentric side.
Right.
And the meeting they had in the hotel, our big hotel, it was our big hotel. Huntsville. The
Not the Russell Erskine.
Russell Erskine.
Oh, okay.
It seems that some women's group was having a welcoming party for the, and they had invited a speaker of some consequence, I don't remember who it was, to address the group. And on the table, the head table, Von Braun was going to be sitting there, of course. They had a nice big basket of fruit, highly decorative.
Mm-hmm.
And the speaker was late. And by the time he got there, Von Braun had practically stripped what would be ordinarily a floral piece, but this was a fruit piece.
Mm-hmm.
He sat there eating grapes and whatnot. So the women were curious. But he was, he trusted, I think, Reese implicitly, and rightly so, because Reese sometimes he used to annoy me at his, some of his insistence on this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, like Rudolph, for instance, who was the subject of this inquiry by the Special Projects Office in Washington.
Oh, yes.
He would have briefings, and I would attend some of those briefings, as few as I could, as a matter of fact. But he had a board set up in his briefing room. And he had his, every one of his sub-project engineers came in and had to deliver a briefing relating to their specific project as it was on the board. And every time Rudolph had these questions, and he would insist at every beginning of every meeting that we are dealing with human lives.
Mm-hmm.
Lives, he said it would have been.
Lives?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these guys would dread these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time there was something that turned up on Rudolph's questions, and I'd hate to have him as a prosecutor, he would go into it in great detail. Then he would make a note in triplicate. One copy was pinned to the board under that project. One was put in Arthur Rudolph's notebook, and the other one was given to the project manager.
Mm-hmm.
And before anything was done at the next meeting, why, those had to all be clear.
These are action items?
Action items.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you can imagine how many. These were mostly dealing with the engine.
Mm.
Rudolph was the guy who really brought the first reaction engine over to. That was the V1, V2.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to clear those. And those meetings lasted until 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning.
You are kidding. Are
not, and you say we would not have our briefing will not begin till after work is done on this date. We will be have our briefing. And those guys never got to know what their wives look like after.
Oh, I'll bet.
But he stuck, and he himself conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the degree.
This is when he headed up the Saturn V. Overall development.
Well, I think he was primarily concerned with the engine.
Oh, okay.
And some of the others were the same way. And there's no question, time, nothing to it. You were there, and if you weren't there, why they called you and called you.
Right.
But it's that degree of meticulous attention
mm-hmm.
that was driven by the
mm-hmm.
fully accepted by his team leaders. Well, they tell a story about, I wasn't there when it happened, that one of the younger engineers raised his hand about 1 o'clock in the morning. He says, the doctor, Rudolph, I have to go to the bathroom. And he says, you have thought, you should have thought of this, you knew the briefing was coming. And as I say, all their test engine tests and all of those were thoroughly instrumented. So as a consequence, after them, these were all reviewed, and if they were below the red line, there would be no more tests whatsoever until that particular item was cleared up. They knew when anything went wrong, although it looked like it was a perfect performance. So that was his policy. No question about it. He he kept track of all this. He worked on this. He chauffeur drove him home.
Von Braun.
Yes, he worked in the car on the way. And at the same time, he would suddenly take off for some place like Antarctica. He went down there. He used to say that the only thing connected with the space program he couldn't do was fly as an astronaut. They wouldn't let him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. So
he wanted to very badly, though, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He wanted to do everything.
So was he provided a driver during most of the Apollo project when everything was on such a rigid schedule?
Yeah, he had.
Time was of the essence.
He was, when he was out at the Cape, prior to, he was always right there.
But in Huntsville, did he have a driver also?
Yeah, he had a driver,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the motor pool. Would drive around, and he was always on the go. It was a killing schedule that he kept. And yet he managed to cram in some of these other things that he considered to be necessary for him to understand thoroughly what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And uncomfortable, I would say, in chewing out one of his crew. But Reese wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Reese did the job. When some of these guys were recalcitrant.
Mm-hmm.
Both
the German-born members of the team.
Oh, yeah. I want to tell you a funny story. It isn't involved with Braun, but it's illustrative.
Mm-hmm.
He had on his crew, on the head of the propulsion laboratory at the time, test center, the test stand, Carl Heimberg.
Mm-hmm.
Carl died here not too long ago.
Yes.
Carl Heimberg was
a division
master
man. He was what?
He was a master sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese told me all this. Over at Peenemunde, the transportation was critical. They had bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And they complained to von Braun that they wanted to draw one from the bicycle pool to go one. You know, they didn't have enough bicycles to meet this standard. And there were governor bureaucrats there up there observing all this. And they said, no, you don't have bicycles. Well, one time, immediately after a plea for reconsideration of this ban on their, they went down to their bicycle rack in the morning and found that they were there. Wonderful. What had happened was, Reese had told Heinberg, when Brown had told Heinberg, who, as I say, was the master sergeant, that he had to do something to correct his situation. So Heinberg put his crew, he was a typical soft supply sergeant, out and he went and stole all of these bicycles. And it was hell to pay in Pina Mundi, you know. But they had their bikes.
From some of the bureaucrats or whatever.
Yeah, they were furious about this thing.
Well, from the Air Force side.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't stand for that, but they did. They, that was one, tickled the hell out of me, that did. And of course, when Brown was actually on Himmler's blacklist, you knew that.
Yes, and was arrested.
Yeah, and if it hadn't been for the guy they all admired, the general.
Oh, Dornberger.
Dornberger.
Mm-hmm.
Hadn't been Dornberger, hadn't gone to
Hitler. I've read about that. Let me, about the bicycles now, Heinberg at Pina Mundi was a master sergeant, or you mean he had been?
He was a master sergeant.
Ah. And in the active military.
That's right. The general, he was
at Pina Mundi. Did he later become a
member? He was one of those selected by von Braun to go on the trip to the U.S. forces.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. But was he the head of testing at Pina Mundi as a master sergeant?
Not at Pina Mundi.
Oh, okay.
But here.
I know he later became
the
head of testing.
He supervised the construction of those test stands.
Yes.
That was some job, too.
Oh, yes. Big job.
You take the equivalent of about 2.5 million horsepower, which that first stage generated.
Did von Braun ever tell you of any near misses he had with in his flying, as a pilot himself?
No, and I made a point of his aircraft crew over there, they were really top-notch pilots. One of them was a hurricane hunter. And they all insisted that when Brown, he could ride anywhere with him. He was a good pilot. And I think if he didn't have his notes with him.
that's a funny story.
Yeah,
I'm certainly going to use that.
There's another one that story that amused the hell out of me. It didn't involve von Braun directly. But there was one, and I can't remember his name exactly. He had a German name, Dr. Herr Dr. Professor. That's as high as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a nuisance. They said none of the other people wanted him to in their operation. But von Braun put the hit on the right answer. He transferred him down to the office of Karl Heinberg. Where he continued his autocratic way. I found out this one because I was Army liaison, obviously, in connection with the Redstone Scientific Information Center, which was one of the finest technical libraries in the country, and certainly the finest in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over there one day just to see what something bothered me, because we kept getting these requests for funds to buy expensive publications, you know, very, very expensive. Not at all unusual to pay $150, $200 for a book.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that's a big drain on the funds. I wonder what is it? So I went over to the library, which I should have done anyway, and found out that their big problem was people drawing these books out and forgetting to return them.
Mm-hmm.
And high on the list was our friend. And I came back that evening or the next evening. They had a little party or something, which I went to, and Carl was a great favorite of mine. And he asked me, how were things going? I said, well, not so good. Oh, he said, it's funny, it's in your laboratory too, Carl. Well, that lit him up like a Roman candle, you know, something wrong with his operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I explained to him that this guy had taken numerous books out of the Redstone Scientific Information Center. He never returned them. And I assume they're in his office, and his office is in your laboratory. Mm-hmm. Well, he says he's going to be gone on the travel. He says, I give him as much travel as I can. He just to get him out of the way. He said, and we will go look and see what's going on. So he went into this bird's office, and he found shelf after shelf after shelf of books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure to this day that they were all RSIC books.
Right.
Sure. But Carl was a man of action. So he got his crew, his favorite crew, together, and they got themselves a truck from the bowling pool, and they went to this guy's office, and they took all the books off the shelves, put them in the truck, and took them over to the center. And the center, the poor gals over there, you know, were overwhelmed by this.
Yes.
But then Carl said that they reported back to Carl all the books had been gone. So he says, we'll go back to the office, see what's there. So he went back. And he saw these empty shelves, and he says, without any books, why does he need shelves? Take them out.
How did this guy come to join the lab anyway?
Had all kinds of credentials, educational wise.
But he was a German, but not one of the original.
He was one of the originals. He'd been there, and apparently when Brown thought he had something to offer, he gave him research assignments, you know. He was pretty diligent in carrying them out, but the oil might have been a dagger. Carl called me up, and he says, there are now no more over two books in my laboratory. If you want some more, go to some of these other laboratories. Maybe the same thing is there. Matter of fact, there was, but nothing like this guy. He is
a big abuser of that.
Yeah, some of them. Carl told me some of them look like they've never been used.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was furious. He maintained he couldn't carry on his research assignments, you know, without having an adequate thing. And he didn't have time to go to the library.
Right.
And that was hard-hearted Carl.
He
up a, they had a trouble on the stands. That some of the union people were, had been, somebody complained to them about the working hours.
Mm-hmm.
So Carl visited the, when they came up, they were on the work, down there on the work stand. He wondered how they got there. And he told me, get out, don't come back. He had a spanner wrench in his hand.
Oh, is
I bet
that
you Carl
right?
Well enough to know that if he had to resort to that, he wouldn't hesitate.
Hmm.
He was a tough
The master guy. Sergeant personality.
He tickled me all the time.
You were still with NASA and Marshall when Dr. Von Braun left to go to headquarters?
He had been advised by Mr. Webb. They tried to get him to Washington before that. Mr. Webb said it would be very unwise for him to go to Washington. He said, they'll eat you alive.
Who told him that?
Mr. Webb.
Oh, Webb did.
Before the, nevertheless, he got this position with Fairchild. And they paid him a good salary.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very nice establishment, a home there that he lived in. And then he had these operations. The first one was for colonic cancer.
What kind of cancer?
Colon.
Colon cancer.
Yeah, I see. And they told him he'd had it. They'd gotten it all and everything. But it returned.
Now, when did he have that surgery, that first surgery?
That was after he left Marshall.
Right, and it was up there.
Yeah.
I heard that he might have known that he had cancer when he left here. Although he was very quiet about
the
it.
Brain, everything he brought up.
Yeah.
Again, it was a case of... I'll tell you another example. He had an operation which then was a killer. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. My son had it, and it's been radically changed. Whereby they rearranged the sinus.
Yes.
What do you call it? I don't know what you call it.
I don't either, but that will be my corrective action of last resort.
I
may have to have that later.
Yeah.
It's a hell of an operation.
Murderous. And many doctors I've talked to about it just mentioned that they have it done was far more serious than it is now. He had that operation, and they told him he would be able to go back to work in a week. 2 days later, he showed up.
Hmm.
He was that sick.
Is that right?
Yeah, I liked the guy very, very much. He was personable. And as I mentioned before, and we didn't follow up on it, he was a little bit loath to lecture his people. He let Eberhardt do that.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And, which Eberhardt didn't mind doing. I mean, if it needed to be done, he did it. He
mm-hmm.
And yet he was the gentlest soul imaginable outside. He was a Bavarian.
Mm-hmm.
And we had countless hours together driving around. Even when I went over to Germany on a trip, he was taking a trip. Going to his hometown, I went down to see him. And he lived in very modest circumstances. But he could be a tough one he wanted to be, I mean.
And he was Bavarian. Hmm?
He was a Bavarian. Of course, you know, von Braun is a Bavarian.
Yes. Yes. I had asked Ruth von Sommer recently whether, you know, how that aristocratic entitlement went. Did the father pass the title on to the firstborn son?
Mm-hmm.
And she said no. And she said in some societies it worked that way, like in England,
mm-hmm.
but that all three sons were barons. And she said her husband, because I asked Ruth about this, was a count.
Yeah.
And that von Braun would joke to Count von Sarma that he outranked him, that the count outranked the baron.
You know, I never heard him mention that. I heard all this from Reese.
Oh, is that right?
I never heard him. He never mentioned it to me once. And he, he thought, I had a pretty good position over there. I was at GS-15, and von Braun found out that some of the guys who were my contemporaries had received super grades over at the Army. This didn't bother me a bit. I thought I was in pretty good hands there.
Mm-hmm.
But he insisted his personnel people to write a new job description, which would put me well into the 16.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around here I have it, and I read it, and I couldn't believe
that
this had anything to do
with it.
What he said, yeah. And then the moratorium dropped in because he was getting a bit out of hand.
Sure.
Certainly my getting it under the terms that he had, what I think would have been exceedingly over.
Mm-hmm. Well, that reflected awfully well on you.
Well, he was very loyal to those people. He remembered me the minute I retired, before I had a retirement ceremony. Now I'd like to get my stuff for his telephone. The next day I had to come up with it.
Hmm.
So, I am prejudiced
right?
in this
one. Oh, I understand. And when did you retire from NASA?
1977.
Mm-hmm.
Eberhard died here a couple of months ago. I think
yes.
He was about 88. He
had all Alzheimer's. Tell me. And other ailments.
His hearing was practically all gone.
Mm-hmm.
I got him going away present a gadget from Radio Shack that's supposed to heighten that. But when he married Maria, she took wonderful care of him. They had all set up down at the in Florida.
Right.
And she's still there.
Yes. I more than a year ago, when I'm working on a book also about the late Milton Cummings, a full-length biography. I may have mentioned that, and I contacted Eberhard's family. By that time, he was in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And they just said he had so few lucid moments, mm-hmm. and that it was. I even sent a prepared list of written questions, mm-hmm. because I knew that he knew Mr. Cummings, but he was not able to communicate, mm-hmm. at that time.
No, he couldn't. She had to do all this. She could would write out the question if there be one, and,
mm-hmm.
and he would. She would catch him in a lucid moment, and he would answer.
Right.
Respond.
Mm-hmm.
But he was definitely under great care.
Yes. Also wrote Mrs. von Braun in Alexandria within the last year, and Ruth von Sarma and Ernst Stuhler had put in a good word for me, mm-hmm. in there, because I know that Mrs. von Braun went to the Cummings' home for some of these dinner parties and some things like that, and she was kind enough to write back a brief note to me saying, I'm sorry, you know, other than my official contacts with Mr. Cummings, I really don't have anything to add or, you know, any comments about any relationship there. She was very apologetic, but also not very helpful.
That's right.
Not at all helpful.
Where is she now?
In Alexandria.
I know they were in Alexandria, this magnificent, rather sizable house.
Oh, and I don't know what her, I mean, about her home, you know, her physical home there. I understand that Peter is with her.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter must have some deficiencies, learning disabilities as a kid, and I don't know about emotional difficulties,
yeah.
but he, I'm told, works at a rather menial job. I'm not sure whether it's at the Library of Congress or some kind of bookstore, but that it's kind of a clerical job.
Yeah.
And some of the friends said that Werner was, and Mrs. von Braun were so unhappy, of course, and I guess disappointed that their only son didn't have a greater potential,
yeah.
for accomplishment in life, but he'd had had those learning disabilities. That was too bad.
Yeah, of course, I never heard much about Peter, except from, again, Eberhard, really casual comments from time to time. But, he was a wealth of information about Werner. He admired Werner very much.
Eberhard did.
Eberhard did.
Yes, I'm sure. Do you recall any eccentric or amusing or whatever personal characteristics of Dr. von Braun? I understand he rarely had any money on him.
That's right.
He'd always have to get somebody else to
if it hadn't been for
pay for lunch or whatever.
Yeah, if it hadn't been for Bonnie Holmes, did you talk to her?
I have in the past, and I have a request into her now to talk with her about this project, and she's getting back to me on that.
I hope so, because she's, of course, a wealth.
Oh, she would be.
She was a great gal. I was very fond of her.
She's been loathe to give many interviews over the years. She just thought that was all private and personal, and she did about four or five years ago, one of our reporters did talk with her and do a personal interview. It was, and she shed some light on that. I'm also talking to Doretta Schlitt, who was Dr. Von Braun's secretary at Peenemunde, who still lives here with her husband, Rudolf Schlitt, who was one of the team members. And I'll be talking with her about some recollections, you know, back in those early days. Any other characteristics or eccentricities of Dr. Von Braun that come to mind?
No, not right off there. He had a number. Have you talked to Jim Shepherd?
I have a call into him also. I know he's still in town. I've only gotten his answering machine, I think, every time I've called there. I talked recently with Frank Williams, another assistant to Von Braun, who is in Slidell, Louisiana now, recently retired from industry. He joined Martin Marietta years and years ago, and then just recently retired.
Yeah.
And he's sharing some stories with me, too.
If it weren't for Bonnie Holmes, I don't know what Deborah would have done. He would put spur of the moment tasks on her. Managed to get through it.
I've got a fairly understand. Oh, I may not have mentioned Jim Daniels. I also talked with him. You remember Jim? Jim was in Washington and here. I gather that while there were some positive aspects of Dr. Von Braun's service in Washington, that some of that was frustrating to him.
Very.
And it just never, and as you said, Webb had warned him he might be eaten alive up there in the Washington bureaucracy
right.
mill. And I'd heard long ago that some of the Washington crowd sort of got the knives out for
yeah,
him.
That's right.
Once he got up there, long-standing envy or jealousy, maybe, that Von Braun was the superstar, and there was some.
There's a good bit of that.
Resentment. Right.
Yeah, he referred to the Office of Special Investigations. I was told that they would probably have gone into from Braun's background in Germany to an extent greater than it was.
Really? If he had lived longer? If Dr. Von Braun had?
Yes, he had.
They
really did a number on Arthur Rudolph, of course.
Oh, yes. I've talked to Pat Richardson at length about that. Pat is just livid that Dr. Rudolph never contacted anybody back here for help or advice or anything.
He just got trapped. Heiserman. There were a lot of us in McGinnis.
Oh, yes.
He
sure did.
This business is a Nazi thing or something. I never really brought it up. But as I said, I didn't want on endless rides when another was Reese. And Everhart, the subject of membership in the Nazi Party. he said anyone, in effect, anyone who ceased, who declined membership in the Nazi Party was in for an exceedingly rough go.
Uh-huh.
In other words, you were a Nazi or you were no good.
Mm-hmm.
And
at least, I mean, if you wouldn't at least nominally join the party.
Yeah. And he told me, I said, well, what about Werner? Where is he standing? I said, Werner just paid no attention to us. If they said he was a Nazi over there, those people need to help him get his job done. Okay, if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then he cited the Himmler. The Himmler never got over what Dornberg did.
Mm-hmm.
Did.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Werner had only one object in mind, and I tell you, he told me that, he said, I tell you this truth. Werner had only one object in mind, and that was to conquer space, get a man on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
That was everything. Anything that didn't contribute to that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that we did that didn't contribute to that, it was out.
And of course, the Nazi war machine didn't really appreciate that. Did you have any contact or learn much about Dr. von Braun during the Fairchild industry years when he was with private industry there?
No, I
for the first time in his life?
Yeah. And that's an interesting point, too, that most of those Germans had fabulous salaries.
Mm-hmm.
If they were willing to step out of what they considered the contract they had with the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
No, they never did. Or one or two of them they have, but not a.
Right, but you're right.
It never occurred to Reese.
Mm-hmm.
Did he do anything but stick with it until he retired?
Mm-hmm.
And from Braun was of the same persuasion, was he? When he retired, he went to Fairchild. I think he got something $250,000 a year, or something like that.
Which was great money, certainly back then.
Yeah. And he was worth it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, his ideas, he liked the hydrogen source.
Mm-hmm. I understand that he worked on such things as educational satellite system and involved the government of India.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be where, was it Margaret who married an Indian man? Von Braun and the family on a few occasions went to India in connection with that project.
Speaking out of turn, but he was a little upset about that.
Oh, was he? Yeah, I won't go into that.
Right. I'm trying to conduct so many things. I think he's just an elect worker, you know. But as I say, he was devoted to his, the loyalty of his crew to him played a large role in the success of the space program.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely devoted their time and attention to the Poitras.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ernst Stuhlinger. I think Ernst and I have the same birthday. And he calls me up every year to remind me that he's a year
respect there. A number of people have told me that Von Braun had this one trait of his was to be respectful to everyone, you know, as a person. That he, whether if it was the janitor or any individual, that he went out of his way not to embarrass somebody or treat someone disrespectfully. He may have had to have some one-on-ones, you know, tough talk, but as you say, he farmed out a lot of that to Everhard.
Yeah.
But did you notice that characteristic
Absolutely.
In him?
He was always respectful to everyone. He never criticized anybody to me.
Mm-hmm.
He may have done so, and I'm sure he did to Everhard. And Everhard would willingly step in.
Right.
And Everhard got after Von Braun a couple of times because some of these people that he had disciplined one way or another went and complained to Von Braun about it. Von Braun wrote it off. And they had quite some arguments about that. Was very rare, though.
I guess, but Von Braun was supportive of Reese, wasn't
Absolutely.
He? When